happiness.com.
Welcome to Climate Change and Happiness, an international podcast that explores the personal side of climate change, your feelings, what the crisis means to you, and how to cope and thrive. And now, your hosts, Thomas Doherty and Panu Pikkala.
Well, hello, I'm Thomas Doherty.
And I am Panu Pikkala.
And welcome to Climate Change and Happiness. This is our podcast. This is a show for people around the world that Panu and I do. And it's meant to really think about our feelings and thoughts about climate change and other environmental issues. And really, the underlying message of our podcast is about exploring happiness and what it means to be happy in the modern world. I mean, the angle that we take is coming at the world from the angle of climate change, this big issue that we're all working through globally, but it opens us up to environmental issues, and it opens us up to a thing that we're going to talk about today, which is nature and our relationship with nature and the natural world. I see this as a kind of a basic set of skills and concepts that we can afford to strengthen our thoughts and feelings about nature and the natural world. So it kind of helps us to even understand why climate change affects us in the first place. So we're going to be working around this idea of nature, which can be a fuzzy concept, but we're going to make it very kind of tangible today. So I've got a number of thoughts about this coming out of my writing and things, but let me just start with you, Panu. Practically, how do you see, you know, nature manifesting for people, either in your work or how you see the culture in Finland? Like, where would we start there? Or what's top of mind for you?
Yes, the Finnish word for nature is luonto. Mm-hmm. And etymologically, that actually comes from something being created. Not typically Finns anymore think of that, but when the word was conceived, there is linguistic links to having been created. And the everyday use of the word luonto is roughly similar than in the Western world in general. People speak about going out to nature, for example. And then I have lots of colleagues in environmental education and environmental studies who are very critical of this parlance, because sometimes they fear that it signals a separation between humans and the rest of nature, you know, going to the nature as if we were not inside nature, so to speak, in our cities and towns and wherever we are mm-hmm. living. So it's a fascinating concept. There's the communicative part. If I talk to my boys that let's go out to nature, it would be quite complicated to say to them that, hey, let's go out to explore other parts of the more than human world. But then in some writing, mm-hmm. these kind of more inclusive concepts are sometimes good to be used. But what about you, Thomas? What's on your mind about nature to begin with?
Well, thanks, Panu. I think starting with the word, the actual word and the language is really a great strategy. What I would say with this is what I've discovered in my own environmental identity and my own grappling with these concepts is that you really need to have a tool belt of language and terms and understanding to really practically, you know, make meaning, like we talked about in our recent episode recording. The analogy that I would take around working with nature concepts is working with emotional feelings in general. If I don't have a good vocabulary list of all my different kinds of feelings, the range of feelings, like the feelings wheel that you worked on, Panu, then it's really hard for me to actually have a real conversation about what I feel about, you know, nature or the environment or climate change. So I need some tools. And a lot of people, you know, lack tools to talk about their emotions in general, and especially their emotions around nature. And I think a lot of people lack tools to talk about the idea of nature or the natural world. So that's why it's good to have these, that have these conversations, because exactly, you're exactly right. Our language plunges us right into deep meanings, like the idea of nature being something that's created. Now that could be interpreted from like a Judeo-Christian context of created by God, you know, and that brings us into the Bible and the Old Testament and all that sort of stuff, or the Quran, or, you know, other, you know, origin stories of different cultures. All cultures have origin stories. The idea of it being created could also be created by the creator, like in Native American religion, the creator is something a little broader, you know, or the Tao, you know. So yes, there is this idea of sacredness and mystery and creation. And that brings us into this idea of stewardship and taking care of nature. So that's really juicy to get into. And so it's like deep water. Like I was talking to Panu earlier, this analogy is like we're swimming in a pond, like a nice pond in the summer day. If you ever had a chance to do that, the water at the surface is kind of clear and you could see down below several feet and it's warm and you could swim around. But if you dip deeper, the water's colder, it's darker, and there's more under the surface. And if you go down to the bottom, there's the sediment and the history. So it's going down and down and down and down and down. And that whole separation thing. Let's hold the separation danger for a second. We'll come back to that, because that's the danger with all concepts, right? We split things up, self and other, self and nature. But one thing that I think is really useful is our values about stepping back and thinking about our values about nature and the natural world. And I've got a list and typology that I'll talk about in a second. But what are some, you know, going out to nature in Finland, for example, what do you think are some of the values that, you know, even you and your boys are, you know, exercising when you're doing that? Or what are some of the values you've seen people ascribe to this kind of going outside, going outdoors?
For Finnish people, going outdoors is a very important thing. And of course, there's been growing urbanization and technologization during the last decades, but still. And even our cities usually have some forests in them. There's lots of water, both the Baltic Sea and lots of fresh water given by the ice age in Finland. So going nearby water or on top of water, either by boat or walking on ice during winters, that's a major part in Finnish outdoor life. Life also. And then different kinds of values are present there. One could think about appreciation of various kinds of environments and nature, so to speak. So-called natural environments are highly appreciated by many people, but there's also usually strong ambiguities between utilitarian use of those natural environments, so using them for some economic gains, for example. The value of autonomy is quite important for Finns, and in the Nordic countries we have this tradition of every man's rights, which is often striking for people coming from Central Europe, even because traditionally and still today it's permitted to, for example, pick mushrooms and berries and set up a tent in the forests, unless you are really next to somebody's backyard type of thing. So what you can legally do in outdoors, that's quite open in places like Finland and Sweden compared to lots of parts of the world currently. And that reflects this value of autonomy also, and so it's sort of egalitarian values, meaning that people have strong beliefs that everybody should have access to these outdoor spaces. So the idea of somebody putting a fence around a city forest and starting to charge people of entering, that would be quite outrageous for Finns, and that tells something of the values. There would be much, much more, but I'll throw the ball back to you at this point.
Yeah, no, it's great. So, I mean, just for the listeners, one of the big values around nature and the natural world for all people are their cultural values, because there's certain cultural values that come into play. And yes, so in Finland, they have this, and it's not unique to Finland, but you know, there's a value of connecting with the out-of-doors and freedom, autonomy, all these things. People in the U.S. and in other countries can tap into this too. But it is different in different countries, and there's different political systems and all this other sort of stuff. I mean, practically, when I'm working with people around some of this stuff, like the broad idea of how to get reconnected with nature, and we've been touching on this already, I start with something really simple, just the spectrum of different settings that we consider to be nature or natural, or to have some kind of natural aspect to them. Even if we just allow ourselves to stay with that division for a second of people, ourself versus nature, as if nature is something, a thing that is different than us, which isn't technically true, but it's practically true in some ways in our modern life. If we stay with that, you know, we have a spectrum of nature. So we have nature in our home. You know, we actually have, there's a spectrum from virtual nature to wild nature. You know, so virtual nature is paintings, art, sculptures. Behind me in my office wall, there's a big blown up photo of a beautiful lake. You know, that's a image, but it's virtual. But that actually has benefit for people aesthetically, and even a nicely decorated room has physiological benefits for your heart rate and blood pressure. So we have virtual nature in our lives, which is healthy. We have nearby nature, which is the nature right around us in our home. So we call that domestic nature. Like if you have plants or your pets, an aquarium, a deck, or an open space in your home that opens to the outdoors. So there's sort of an opening to the outer world in your home. Those are kind of domestic nature. And then you have nearby nature, which is parks and gardens and green spaces in your town or your city. Even in New York City, there's Central Park, which is a beautiful example of nearby nature and has its own history and behind it. And then we have managed nature, or what I call working nature, which is basically rural areas where there's farms, working forests, even oil wells and mines and various things. Those are natural too, but they're fully, some of these places are fully, you know, subjugated to human extraction, but they're still nature. An open pit, you know, copper mine is a place on the spectrum of nature. And then there's the idea of, you know, wild nature, you know, mountains, deserts, deep forests. And in the U.S. we have this idea of wilderness areas that are legal designations for areas where you can't build roads or you can't use machines. And so that's helpful for people to say, oh, okay, where do I fit? Like some people have a dominant setting that they spend most of their time in, or some people stretch and go to different kinds of settings. Some people consider themselves to be, you know, wilderness type people, or wild, you know, where they want to be in wild nature a lot. That would, you know, so that's in Finland, of course. There's that idea of the wild forests and the reindeer and the Sami people and that kind of thing. And then of course you've got a whole, you know, working forest spectrum there. So that, I think, that's helpful for people, and we can have a whole conversation just about that, because it's helpful to expand ourselves. Some people don't give their virtual and domestic nature enough credit, so they don't, you know, if we beautify our lives and beautify our spaces, that brings nature into our life in a very palpable way, because we can't always get out to the wilderness. But it also brings in the whole idea of justice, because not everyone is lucky enough to have parks and gardens nearby, or a beautiful home with windows and natural light. And then with climate change, it's always threatening all of our values, because, you know, with urban heat islands, with low-income neighborhoods, they don't have trees and it's hot. And so, but that spectrum, I think, is a good start. And in therapy, sometimes people have specific goals about their nature spectrum. Like they want to learn how to do hiking or do an outdoor sport like skiing, or you know, someone wants to take a special trip to travel from the U.S. to go to some beautiful place they've always wanted to go to. Like, I've worked with someone years ago who spent many years planning to be able to go to Africa and trek into the up into the highlands to see gorillas in their habitat, and that was a life dream of them, of theirs, for example. Or someone wants to travel to Europe and hike the Camino, one of the ancient pilgrimage routes. So it becomes, all of us, I think, harbor dreams about nature in our, even just that spectrum. Some people aspire to have a place of land, a piece of land that they could live on, or they aspire to have a beautiful home, or like me, I aspire to have house plants that stay alive in my home. Yeah, what comes up for you around this idea of a spectrum of settings where nature is revealed?
When I was more involved with environmental education, often with adults, one of the activities I used was asking people to think about what did this place look like before humans built anything here or modified this area in any other means, for example, changing the courses of rivers or lakes.
Mm-hmm.
And that was often eye-opening for many Finns. Even though internationally compared, there's often talk about Finns having more nature connection than some of the more urbanized countries and peoples. But of course, there's been strong effects of urbanization here also, as I mentioned. And one aspect of that is that people sometimes think that the way that the place has looked like when they have seen it, so that's the sort of fundamental character of the place. And the idea that, hey, there was actually trees and rocks and streams here before we built anything here, that's often eye-opening for people, and it's linked to this distinction connection thing that we mentioned. I'm also thinking of the book End of Nature by Bill McKibben, this famous book mm-hmm. about environmental issues and climate change, and the sort of provocative argument that there is no more nature in the old sense because the impacts of humanity, at least in forms of particles, are reaching all over the globe. But of course, that argument is related to this distinction. But anyway, McKibben's point was to raise awareness of very important global environmental problems. So that was there also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. I mean, again, I think this image of swimming in a pond is helpful because it's very deep waters that we're swimming in, and we're just sort of touching. We're on the surface and we're dipping down into these juicy ideas. The idea of what they call shifting baselines, right? Yeah. So I grew up, and I think this, wherever you live, you think this is the, like you say, exactly, it's well said. You think this is the character of a place. I mean, one of the senses of the definition of nature is the nature of something, the essence of it. What is the essence of it? And you might think a city is the essence of a place, but really, like you say, Pano, if you do that thought experiment and go back 100 years, 200 years, or 1,000 years, depending, you know, on where you live in the world, or 10,000 years, you know, what is the essence then? The essence is different. You know, one of the things I've been writing about is the idea of a land acknowledgement, which is a thing that's in vogue here in the U.S., where people will acknowledge the place and the native tribes where that have been historically in an area and often have had their lands taken away. And it's more popular, you know, in the era, since the era of Black Lives Matter movement. It's really addressing, you know, oppression and things. But that place acknowledgement to me is really a doorway into so many different things. And that's, I almost feel like I'm tumbling in space and time when I'm doing that, just like you say, because like, what is the essence of a place? How far back do you go? And there's no end to it. The whole idea of essence becomes something more nuanced, and it's like a process. Nature is really an ongoing, ever-changing process. You know, even here in the where I live in the U.S., if you go back far enough, there was natives here. But if you go back farther than that, there were no people at all here. The trees were here, the landscape, the salmon, all those beings were here. If you go back farther, there were glaciers covering this area, you know, that were miles thick. And you go back farther still, the trees that are here that are native had migrated themselves from other parts of the country. So there's no, it's an endless flux and change, which is beautiful, but it's also mysterious, and it's also kind of like I say, I feel like I'm being tumbled head over heels in space and time. So that's just a good thing for the listeners to realize. Once you tap into these ideas, it will disorient you. That's why I like to start with simple structures like your setting, because it helps people. But then really, you know, what I'll tell people is experiment with just thinking of nature as relationship and process. So when you say, I want to reconnect with nature, talk about reconnecting with processes and with relationships. So each of those settings I talked about, like your virtual nature, like your images and your home and your, they're all settings where nature can reveal itself to us in all the different processes, right? So there's an ongoing thing going on there. It isn't a thing that's separate from us, right? So that's where I start to bring in some of that deeper philosophy. Yeah, what are you thinking there?
Yeah, that's one of the very important reminders coming from indigenous people, is not to think of objects when we think of nature, so to speak, but to think of relations.
Yeah.
So I think that goes to the heart of matter. And the idea of thinking about what was here before and going back to times when humans, or perhaps even human ancestors, were not here, that can be one way to gain some humility and also experience some awe, perhaps. And those sometimes can help us to move away from overly dominionistic attitudes towards the rest of the nature or the more than human world. So sort of finding our human place in the web of things is of course quite paramount, and that's been much of course discussed and practiced in environmental education and eco-psychology and other fields, but it's challenging often to get people into that deeper reflection and realizing the relationality and interconnectedness and interdependence, or also this old to exist is to coexist.
Yeah.
Idea that we are not really so separate as we have often in the Western world been socialized to believe. And of course then modern science reveals constantly new aspects of that we have so-called nature in our bodies in the form of numerous living organisms, for example, and there's lots of symbiotic things going on between things on our skin and things that are a bit further away from our skin, and all this goes towards the need to understand how interconnected we truly are.
Yeah, exactly. So going forward, listeners, you can have an experiment yourself. Just, you know, when you're thinking about any kind of concept or idea about nature, try to remind yourself nature is not a thing. It is a process, it's a system, it's a movement, and it's always growing and changing. And so when we're feeling, a lot of people feel disconnected because the language and the, you know, the cultural values act as if nature is a thing, but it's an illusion. It's an illusion. Our nature is a part of ourselves. So again, when someone's like going out to nature, let's go out to a place where we can really be in touch with our relationships with things. You know, that's a way to think about it. And then, yeah, there's all these cultural values. Like we started out talking about the Finnish values, one of the values that's big in Finland and in other countries in the U.S. is an experiential value, like is literally doing things in nature. So it's the actual experience, feeling this air on your skin, being out in the wind, exercising, skiing, hiking, walking. Those, that's a really big kind of value for many people. So it's a value of embodied experience, you know, direct contact, active engagement. And there are other values that we're touching on, ethical values. With climate change, one of the biggest threats is that it threatens our sense of right and wrong and reverence in the natural order. And then, you know, there's that ecology systems value too, that there's a web of life. So there are all these beautiful values underneath this, even when that's difficult. That's why I like the link to values and feelings, because there's all of our feelings that we have about nature or the world or anything are natural and valid, and they're interesting and beautiful in their way, even sad feelings, and they have a place. And so we have all these nature values as well that we can start to think about. There's nothing wrong with trying to control and master some aspect of nature. If we're trying to do landscaping, or if we're trying to breed a certain flower or something like that, in its right place, that's a very primal aspect of humans to and other creatures too, to kind of change the environment around them. But our danger in our modern world is the scale and the moral and ethics of industrialized, you know, massive changes and stuff like that. So it's, again, we're swimming in this water of a lot of deep stuff here.
Yeah, that's very good topics for this discussion. And the question about humans as mammals and what our so-called natural behavior goes into some of the challenges in environmental thinking and environmental protection also. So if we take human abilities and desires to modify our environments as some kind of natural behavior, then how do we integrate the ethical component there? It's not impossible, and even folks like Aldo Leopold, who we have mentioned in this podcast, one of the pioneers of conservation in the US and globally, so he also had already some quite profound ideas of how this can be argued. But still, we go into the fascinating and complex issue of what it means to be human. So that's a big topic. But as you say, Thomas, getting into relationships with the more than human world, that's usually important. And I think also for coping with difficult climate emotions, for example. We have an earlier episode where we discuss the challenges of grief becoming a barrier for enjoying nature.
Yep.
And we argued there that it's a threshold that needs to be overcome with the help of others and with the help of more than human others also. And personally, the relationships and connections with both house plants and the nearby forests and skiing on snow and all those kinds of things, that's a very important thing in coping with climate change also. So there's profound links between that topic and what we have been discussing under the rubric of nature.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. Trebi Johnson, who we interviewed, you know, talked about going out to damaged places, like visiting a sick relative or visiting a sick friend. And sometimes we don't want to do that, but we rarely ever regret something like that. And that's actually it's the trepidation and apprehension about doing it that's more difficult than the actual doing it itself. Once you're out in nature, you're in that realm of the air and the wind and plants and animals and insects. Even in a so-called damaged place, there's a lot of life and interest and potential beauty that's there. And then I just wanted to, while we have a moment, to touch on this term you're mentioning, the more than human world, which is a nice term. It comes from David Abram, a kind of environmental philosopher that Panu and I both like. And it's a neat turn of phrase, you know, rather than saying the non-human world, when we use language like, and you'll see that often in science and things, the non-human world, and that creates this real split, and it's implicit that the non-human world is less than humans. Like we're on top, and there's all this other stuff. You know, there's the non-human world, which is bacteria and animals and blah blah blah. You know, but the other than human world is another way to use it. But that's kind of doesn't really do justice to it as well. It's almost something like we can just dismiss, like, oh, the other than human. But the more than human world says there's, it's more than human. There's more stuff out there, you know? And it also allows even like, oh, it's more than us. Like maybe even it's above us. So that gets into that whole ecological value. So it's really interesting how this stuff is like floating around in our language. So yeah, thinking about the more than human world is another little exercise that you could do. Or even practice using that term in conversation and have people be mystified what you're talking about. But when we talk about the more than human world, then we're kind of dissolving this. We've got to wrap up now. Another person that we like is Andy Fisher, a therapist, and he talks about recollective practices, right? These things that we do to kind of recollect our connection with nature. So that's another thing that we're kind of doing here in this episode is doing some recollective practices. So speaking of nature, I know it's late, Panu, but you've had a long work day. What is your nature calling for you to do this evening here?
Yes, that's another aspect of the word nature related to essence, but also sort of fundamental character of somebody. So it's the borders between winter and the early parts of spring now in Helsinki. So there's ice on the roads, we still have snow, so can't go skiing, but at least there's refreshing moisture in the air and gonna breathe some of that. And what's ahead of you, Thomas, on this day?
Yeah, well, this is leap day here as we're recording it here in the US. It's the last day of February. We have the extra day every 4 years. And so here it's wet and cold. And kind of late winter, but up in the mountains, there's a lot of beautiful snow still here nearby. And so I will be going cross country skiing this weekend. I'm looking forward to that. That'll be getting out to more wild type nature. But today I'm mostly going to be in domestic nature in my home working and virtual nature and enjoying my tulip. Well, domestic nature. I have a tulip plant that's blooming in my office here, and I have my thing. So I'm going to be like most people in the world, mainly indoors today, but keeping in mind that there's that spectrum, and I want to get outdoors when I can. So, listeners, you can think about that as well. This is hopefully an entree into nature and the natural world and values and place that will be helpful. We can keep talking about. So, Panu and everyone, be well.
The Climate Change and Happiness podcast is a self-funded volunteer effort. Please support us so we can keep bringing you messages of coping and thriving. See the donate page at climatechangeandhappiness.com.